Random House Audio presents 2061 Odyssey 3 by Arthur C. Clarke. Read for you by Scott Brick. To the memory of Judy Lynn Del Rey, editor extraordinary, who bought this book for $1 but never knew if she got her money's worth. Foreword. 65 years and counting. 2061. The View from 1996. Once again, the time has come to survey an enterprise begun more than 30 years ago, before a whole series of scientific discoveries and technological revolutions changed our world almost beyond recognition. When I started writing 2001, A Space Odyssey, on a typewriter, have you seen one lately? Neil Armstrong's one small step was still 5 years in the future, and the moons of Jupiter were dimensionless points of light, their landscapes as unknown as America to the pre-Columbian mapmakers. Yet now, as I write these words, the Galileo space probe is showing us details only a few meters across. Even more amazing, at any moment I can view them here in my own office by pressing a few keys. When, as frequently happens, I press the wrong ones, I hear a familiar voice saying, "I'm sorry, Dave, I can't do that." So there is no avoiding the fact that some elements of a space trilogy conceived in 1964, 1982, and even 1987 may now have a quaint Jane Austen-ish charm. Yet no revision could or should attempt to eliminate them, any more than one should try to update H.G. Wells' The First Men in the Moon. What I have done, therefore, is to leave the existing text, including the various authors' notes and acknowledgments, completely unaltered, but have added a 1996 postscript commenting on the truly astonishing changes that have taken place in technology and politics since Stanley Kubrick and I lunched together in Trader Vic's on April 22, 1964. Author's note. Just as 2010 Odyssey 2 was not a direct sequel to 2001 A Space Odyssey, so this book is not a linear sequel to 2010. They must all be considered as variations on the same theme, involving many of the same characters and situations, but not necessarily happening in the same universe. Developments since 1964. When Stanley Kubrick suggested, 5 years before men landed on the moon, that we should attempt the proverbial good science fiction movie, make total consistency impossible, as the later stories incorporate discoveries and events that had not even taken place when the earlier books were written. 2010 was made possible by the brilliantly successful 1979 Voyager flybys of Jupiter, and I had not intended to return to that territory until the results of the even more ambitious Galileo mission were in. Galileo would have dropped a probe into the Jovian atmosphere while spending almost 2 years visiting all the major satellites. It should have been launched from the space shuttle in May 1986 and would have reached its objective by December 1988. So around 1990, I hoped to take advantage of the flood of new information from Jupiter and its moons. Alas, the Challenger tragedy eliminated that scenario. Galileo, now sitting in its clean room at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, must now find another launch vehicle. It will be lucky if it arrives at Jupiter merely 7 years behind schedule. I have decided not to wait. Arthur C. Clarke, Colombo, Sri Lanka, April 1987. Part 1. The Magic Mountain. Chapter 1. The Frozen Years.
"For a man of 70, you're in extremely good shape," remarked Dr. Glazunov, looking up from the Medcom's final printout. "I'd have put you down as not more than 65.
"Happy to hear it, Oleg, especially as I'm 103, as you know perfectly well."
"Here we go again. Anyone would think you've never read Professor Rudenko's book."
"Dear old Katerina, we'd planned to get together on her 100th birthday. I was so sorry she never made it. That's what comes of spending too much time on Earth.
Ironic, since she was the one who coined that famous slogan, "Gravity is the bringer of old age."
Dr. Heywood Floyd stared thoughtfully at the ever-changing panorama of the beautiful planet, only 6,000 kilometers away, on which he could never walk again. It was even more ironic that, through the most stupid accident of his life, he was still in excellent health when virtually all his old friends were dead. He had been back on Earth only a week when, despite all the warnings and his own determination that nothing of the sort would ever happen to him, he had stepped off that second-story balcony. Yes, he had been celebrating, but he had earned it. He was a hero on the new world to which Leonov had returned. The multiple fractures had led to complications, which could best be handled in the Pasteur Space Hospital. That had been 2015, and now, he could not really believe it, but there was the calendar on the wall. It was 2061. For Heywood Floyd, the biological clock had not merely been slowed down by the 1/6 Earth gravity of the hospital. Twice in his life, it had actually been reversed. It was now generally believed, though some authorities disputed it, that hibernation did more than merely stop the aging process. It encouraged rejuvenation. Floyd had actually become younger on his voyage to Jupiter and back.
"So you really think it's safe for me to go?" "Nothing in this universe is safe, Heywood. All I can say is that there are no physiological objections. After all, your environment will be virtually the same aboard Universe as it is here. She may not have quite the standard of superlative medical expertise we can provide at Pasteur, but Dr. Mahindran is a good man. If there's any problem he can't cope with, he can put you into hibernation again and ship you back to us, COD. It was the verdict that Floyd had hoped for. Yet somehow his pleasure was alloyed with sadness. He would be away for weeks from his home of almost half a century and the new friends of his later years. And although Universe was a luxury liner compared with the primitive Leonov, now hovering high above Farside as one of the main exhibits at the Lagrange Museum, there was still some element of risk in any extended space voyage, especially like the pioneering one on which he was now preparing to embark. Yet that, perhaps, was exactly what he was seeking, even at 103, or according to the complex geriatric accounting of the late Professor Katerina Rudenko, a hale and hearty 65. During the last decade, he had become aware of an increasing restlessness and a vague dissatisfaction with a life that was too comfortable and well-ordered. Despite all the exciting projects in progress around the solar system, the Mars renewal, the establishment of the Mercury base, the greening of Ganymede, there had been no goal on which he could really focus his interests and his still considerable energies. 2 centuries ago, one of the first poets of the scientific era had summed up his feelings perfectly, speaking through the lips of Odysseus, Ulysses. "Life piled on life were all too little, and of one of me little remains. But every hour is saved from that eternal silence, something more, a bringer of new things. And vile it were for some 3 suns to store and hoard myself, and this gray spirit yearning in desire to follow knowledge like a sinking star beyond the utmost bound of human thought." 3 suns, indeed. It was more than 40. Ulysses would have been ashamed of him. But the next verse, which he knew so well, was even more appropriate. "It may be that the gulfs will wash us down. It may be we shall touch the happy isles and see the great Achilles whom we knew. Though much is taken, much abides. And though we are not now that strength which in old days moved earth and heaven, that which we are. One equal temper of heroic hearts, made weak by time and fate, but strong in will, to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield." To seek, to find, Well, now he knew what he was going to seek and to find, because he knew exactly where it would be. Short of some catastrophic accident, there was no way in which it could possibly elude him. It was not a goal he had ever consciously had in mind, and even now he was not quite sure why it had become so suddenly dominant. He would have thought himself immune to the fever that was once again infecting mankind for the second time in his life. But perhaps he was mistaken. Or it could have been that the unexpected invitation to join the short list of distinguished guests aboard Universe had fired his imagination and awakened an enthusiasm he had not even known he possessed. There was another possibility. After all these years, he could still remember what an anticlimax the 1985-86 encounter had been to the general public. Now was a chance, the last for him and the first for humanity, to more than make up for any previous disappointment. Back in the 20th century, only flybys had been possible. This time, there would be an actual landing, as pioneering in its way as Armstrong and Aldrin's first steps on the moon. Dr. Haywood Floyd, veteran of the 2010-15 mission to Jupiter, let his imagination fly outward to the ghostly visitor once again returning from the deeps of space, gaining speed second by second as it prepared to round the sun. And between the orbits of Earth and Venus, the most famous of all comets would meet the still uncompleted space liner Universe on its maiden flight. The exact point of rendezvous was not yet settled, but his decision was already made. "Hallie, here I come," whispered Haywood Floyd. Chapter 2 First Sight. It is not true that one must leave Earth to appreciate the full splendor of the heavens. Not even in space is the starry sky more glorious than when viewed from a high mountain on a perfectly clear night, far from any source of artificial illumination. Even though the stars appear brighter beyond the atmosphere, the eye cannot really appreciate the difference, and the overwhelming spectacle of half the celestial sphere at a single glance is something that no observation window can provide. But Haywood Floyd was more than content with his private view of the universe, especially during the times when the residential zone was on the shadow side of the slowly revolving space hospital. Then there would be nothing in his rectangular field of view but stars, planets, nebulae, and occasionally, drowning out all else, the unblinking glare of Lucifer, new rival to the sun. About 10 minutes before the beginning of his artificial night, he would switch off all the cabin lights, even the red emergency standby, so that he could become completely dark-adapted. A little late in life for a space engineer, he had learned the pleasures of naked-eye astronomy and could now identify virtually any constellation, even if he could glimpse only a small portion of it. Almost every night that May, as the comet was passing inside the orbit of Mars, he had checked its location on the star charts. Although it was an easy object to find with a good pair of binoculars, Floyd had stubbornly resisted their aid. He was playing a little game, seeing how well his aging eyes would respond to the challenge. Though two astronomers on Mauna Kea already claimed to have observed the comet visually, no one believed them, and similar assertions from other residents of Pasteur had been treated with even greater skepticism. But tonight, a magnitude of at least 6 was predicted. He might be in luck. He traced the line from gamma to epsilon and stared toward the apex of an imaginary equilateral triangle set upon it, almost as if he could focus his vision across the solar system by a sheer effort of will. And there it was. Just as he had first seen it 76 years ago, inconspicuous but unmistakable. If he had not known exactly where to look, he would not even have noticed it, or would have dismissed it as some distant nebula. To his naked eye, it was merely a tiny, perfectly circular blob of mist. Strain as he could, he was unable to detect any trace of a tail. But the small flotilla of probes that had been escorting the comet for months had already recorded the first outbursts of dust and gas that would soon create a glowing plume across the stars, pointing directly away from its creator, the sun. Like everyone else, Heywood Floyd had watched the transformation of the cold, dark, no, almost black, nucleus as it entered the inner solar system. After 70 years of deep freeze, the complex mixture of water, ammonia, and other ices was beginning to thaw and bubble. A flying mountain roughly the shape and size of the island of Manhattan was turning on a cosmic spit every 53 hours. As the heat of the sun seeped through the insulating crust, the vaporizing gases were making Halley's Comet behave like a leaking steam boiler. Jets of water vapor, mixed with dust and a witch's brew of organic chemicals, were bursting out from half a dozen small craters. The largest, about the size of a football field, erupted regularly about 2 hours after local dawn. It looked exactly like a terrestrial geyser and had been promptly christened Old Faithful. Already he had fantasies of standing on the rim of that crater, waiting for the sun to rise above the dark, contorted landscape that he already knew well through the images from space. True, the contract said nothing about passengers, as opposed to crew and scientific personnel going outside the ship when it landed on Halley. On the other hand, there was also nothing in the small print that specifically forbade it. "They'll have a job to stop me," thought Heywood Floyd. "I'm sure I can still handle a spacesuit. And if I'm wrong." He remembered reading that a visitor to the Taj Mahal had once remarked, "I'd die tomorrow for a monument like this." He would gladly settle for Halley's Comet. Chapter 3. Re-entry. Even apart from that embarrassing accident, the return to Earth had not been easy. The first shock had come soon after revival, when Dr. Rudenko had awakened him from his long sleep. Walter Kurnai was hovering beside her, and even in his semi-conscious state, Floyd could tell that something was wrong. Their pleasure at seeing him awake was a little too exaggerated, and failed to conceal a sense of strain. Not until he was fully recovered did they let him know that Dr. Chandra was no longer with them. Somewhere beyond Mars, so imperceptibly that the monitors could not pinpoint the time, he had simply ceased to live. His body, set adrift in space, had continued unchecked along Leonov's orbit and had long since been consumed by the fires of the sun. The cause of death was totally unknown, but Max Brailovsky expressed a view that, highly unscientific though it was, not even Surgeon Commander Katerina Rudenko attempted to refute. "He couldn't live without Hal." Walter Kurnai, of all people, added another thought. "I wonder how Hal will take it. Something out there must be monitoring all our broadcasts. Sooner or later, he'll know." And now Kurnai was gone too. So were they all, except little Xenia. He had not seen her for 20 years, but her card arrived punctually every Christmas. The last one was still pinned above his desk. It showed a troika laden with gifts speeding through the snows of a Russian winter, watched by extremely hungry-looking wolves. 45 years! Sometimes it seemed only yesterday that Leonov had returned to Earth orbit and the applause of all mankind. Yet it had been a curiously subdued applause, respectful but lacking genuine enthusiasm. The mission to Jupiter had been altogether too much of a success. It had opened a Pandora's box, the full contents of which had yet to be disclosed. When the black monolith known as Tycho Magnetic Anomaly 1 had been excavated on the moon, only a handful of men knew of its existence. Not until after Discovery's ill-fated voyage to Jupiter did the world learn that 4 million years ago, another intelligence had passed through the solar system and left its calling card. The news was a revelation, but not a surprise. Something of the sort had been expected for decades. And it had all happened long before the human race existed, Although some mysterious accident had befallen Discovery out around Jupiter, there was no real evidence that it involved anything more than a shipboard malfunction. Although the philosophical consequences of TMA-1 were profound, for all practical purposes, mankind was still alone in the universe. Now, that was no longer true. Only light minutes away, a mere stone's throw in the cosmos, was an intelligence that could create a star, and for its own inscrutable purpose, destroy a planet 1,000 times the size of Earth. Even more ominous was the fact that it had shown awareness of mankind through the last message that Discovery had beamed back from the moons of Jupiter just before the fiery birth of Lucifer had destroyed it. All these worlds are yours, except Europa. Attempt no landings there. The brilliant new star, which had banished night except for the few months in each year when it was passing behind the sun, had brought both hope and fear to mankind. Fear, because the unknown, especially when it appeared linked with omnipotence, could not fail to rouse such primeval emotions. Hope, because of the transformation it had wrought in global politics. It had often been said that the only thing that could unite mankind was a threat from space. Whether Lucifer was a threat, no one knew. But it was certainly a challenge. And that, as it turned out, was enough. Heywood Floyd had watched the geopolitical changes from his vantage point on Pasteur, almost as if he were an alien observer himself. At first he had no intention of remaining in space, once his recovery was complete. To the baffled annoyance of his doctors, that took an altogether unreasonable length of time. Looking back from the tranquility of later years, Floyd knew exactly why his bones refused to mend. He simply did not wish to return to Earth. There was nothing for him down on the dazzling blue and white globe that filled his sky. There were times when he could well understand how Chandra might have lost the will to live. It was pure chance that he had not been with his first wife on that flight to Europe. Now Marion was dead. Her memory seemed part of another life that might have belonged to someone else, and their two daughters were amiable strangers with families of their own. But he had lost Caroline through his own actions, even though he had no real choice in the matter. She had never understood. Had he really done so himself? Why he had left the beautiful home they had made together to exile himself for years in the cold wastes far from the sun. Though he had known, even before the mission was half over, that Caroline would not wait, he had hoped desperately that Chris would forgive him. But even this consolation had been denied. His son had been without a father for too long. By the time Floyd returned, Chris had found another in the man who had taken Floyd's place in Caroline's life. The estrangement was complete. Floyd thought he would never get over it. But of course he did. After a fashion. His body had cunningly conspired with his unconscious desires. When at last he returned to Earth after his protracted convalescence in Pasteur, he promptly developed such alarming symptoms, including something suspiciously like bone necrosis, that he was immediately rushed back to orbit. And there he had stayed, apart from a few excursions to the moon, completely adapted to living in the 0-1/6 gravity regime of the slowly rotating space hospital. He was not a recluse, far from it. Even while he was convalescing, he was dictating reports, giving evidence to endless commissions, being interviewed by media representatives. He was a famous man and enjoyed the experience, while it lasted. It helped to compensate for his inner wounds. The first complete decade, 2020-2030, seemed to have passed so swiftly that he now found it difficult to focus upon it. There were the usual crises, scandals, crimes, catastrophes, notably the great Californian earthquake, whose aftermath he had watched with fascinated horror through the station's monitor screens. Under their greatest magnification, in favorable conditions, they could show individual human beings. but from his god's eye view, it had been impossible to identify with the scurrying dots fleeing from the burning cities. Only the ground cameras revealed the true horror. During that decade, though the results would not be apparent until later, the political tectonic plates were moving as inexorably as the geological ones. Yet, in the opposite sense, as if time were running backward. For in the beginning, the Earth had possessed the single supercontinent of Pangaea, which over the eons had split asunder. So had the human species, into innumerable tribes and nations. Now it was merging together, as the old linguistic and cultural divisions began to blur. Although Lucifer had accelerated the process, it had begun decades earlier, when the coming of the Jet Age had triggered an explosion of global tourism. At almost the same time, it was not, of course, a coincidence, satellites and fiber optics had revolutionized communications. With the historic abolition of long-distance charges on 31 December 2000, every telephone call became a local one, and the human race greeted the new millennium by transforming itself into one huge, gossiping family. Like most families, it was not always a peaceful one, but its disputes no longer threatened the entire planet. The second and last nuclear war saw the use in combat of no more bombs than the first. Precisely two. And though the kilotonnage was greater, the casualties were far fewer, as both were used against sparsely populated oil installations. At that point, the big three of China, the U.S., and the USSR moved with commendable speed and wisdom, sealing off the battle zone until the surviving combatants had come to their senses. By the decade of 2020 to 30, a major war between great powers was as unthinkable as one between Canada and the United States had been in the century before. This was not due to any vast improvement in human nature, or indeed to any single factor except the normal preference for life over death. Much of the machinery of peace was not even consciously planned. Before the politicians realized what had happened, they discovered that it was in place and functioning well. No statesman, no idealist of any persuasion invented the peace hostage movement. The very name was not coined until well after someone had noticed that at any given moment there were 100,000 Russian tourists in the United States and 500,000 Americans in the Soviet Union, most of them engaged in their traditional pastime of complaining about the plumbing. And perhaps even more to the point, both groups contained a disproportionately large number of highly non-expendable individuals, the sons and daughters of wealth, privilege, and political power. And even if one wished, it was no longer possible to plan a large-scale war. The age of transparency had dawned in the 1990s, when enterprising news media had started to launch photographic satellites with resolutions comparable to those that the military had possessed for three decades. The Pentagon and the Kremlin were furious, but they were no match for Reuters, Associated Press, and the unsleeping 24-hours-a-day cameras of the Orbital News Service. By 2060, even though the world had not been completely disarmed, it had been effectively pacified, and the 50 remaining nuclear weapons were all under international control. There was surprisingly little opposition when that popular monarch, Edward VIII, was elected the first planetary president, only a dozen states dissenting. They ranged in size and importance from the still stubbornly neutral Swiss, whose restaurants and hotels nevertheless greeted the new bureaucracy with open arms, to the even more fanatically independent Malvinians, who now resisted all attempts by the exasperated British and Argentines to foist them off on each other. The dismantling of the vast and wholly parasitic armaments industry had given an unprecedented, sometimes indeed unhealthy, boost to the world economy. No longer were vital raw materials and brilliant engineering talents swallowed up in a virtual black hole, or even worse, turned to destruction. Instead, they could be used to repair the ravages and neglect of centuries by rebuilding the world and building new ones. Now indeed mankind had found the moral equivalent of war, and a challenge that could absorb the surplus energies of the race for as many millennia ahead as anyone dared to dream.
Chapter 4. Tycoon.
When he was born, William Tsung had been called the most expensive baby in the world. He held the title for only 2 years before it was claimed by his sister. She still held it, and now that the family laws had been repealed, it would never be challenged. Their father, the legendary Sir Lawrence, had been born when China had reinstituted the stringent one-child, one-family rule. His generation had provided psychologists and social scientists with material for endless studies. Having no brothers or sisters, and in many cases no uncles or aunts, it was unique in human history. Whether credit was due to the resilience of the species or the merit of the Chinese extended family system would probably never be settled. The fact remained that the children of that strange time were remarkably free from scars. But they were certainly not unaffected, and Sir Lawrence had done his somewhat spectacular best to make up for the isolation of his infancy. When his second child was born in 22, the licensing system had become law. You could have as many children as you wished, provided only that you paid the appropriate fee. The surviving old guard communists were not the only ones who thought the whole scheme perfectly appalling, but they were outvoted by their pragmatic colleagues in the fledgling Congress of the People's Democratic Republic. Numbers 1 and 2 were free. Number 3 cost 1 million sols. Number 4 was 2 million. Number 5 was 4 million, and so on. The fact that, in theory, there were no capitalists in the People's Republic was cheerfully ignored. Young Mr. Tsung, that was years, of course, before King Edward made him a knight commander of the Order of the British Empire, never revealed if he had any target in mind. He was still a fairly poor millionaire when his fifth child was born. But he was still only 40, and when the purchase of Hong Kong did not take quite as much of his capital as he had feared, he discovered that he had a considerable amount of small change in hand. So ran the legend. But like many other stories about Sir Lawrence, it was hard to distinguish fact from mythology. There was certainly no truth in the persistent rumor that he had made his first fortune through the famous shoebox-sized pirate edition of the Library of Congress. The whole molecular memory module racket was an off-Earth operation, made possible by the United States' failure to sign the Lunar Treaty. Even though Sir Lawrence was not a multi-trillionaire, the complex of corporations he had built up made him the greatest financial power on Earth. No small achievement for the son of a humble videocassette peddler in what was still known as the New Territories. He probably never noticed the 8 million for child number 6, or even the 32 for number 8. The 64 he had to advance on number 9 attracted world publicity, and after number 10, the bets placed on his future plans may well have exceeded the 256 million the next child would have cost him. However, at that point, the Lady Jasmine, who combined the best properties of steel and silk in exquisite proportion, decided that the Song dynasty was adequately established. It was quite by chance, if there is such a thing, that Sir Lawrence became personally involved in the space business. He had, of course, extensive maritime and aeronautical interests, but these were handled by his 5 sons and their associates. Sir Lawrence's real love was communications, newspapers, those few that were left, books, magazines, paper and electronic, and above all, the global television networks. Then he had bought the magnificent old Peninsular Hotel, which to a poor Chinese boy had once seemed the very symbol of wealth and power, and turned it into his residence and main office. He surrounded it by a beautiful park, by the simple expedient of pushing the huge shopping centers underground. His newly formed Laser Excavation Corporation made a fortune in the process and set a precedent for many other cities. One day, as he was admiring the unparalleled skyline of the city across the harbor, he decided that a further improvement was necessary. The view from the lower floors of the peninsula had been blocked for decades by a large building looking like a squashed golf ball.
This, Sir Lawrence decided, would have to go. The director of the Hong Kong Planetarium, widely considered to be among the five best in the world, had other ideas, and very soon Sir Lawrence was delighted to discover someone he could not buy at any price. The two men became firm friends, but when Dr. Hessenstein arranged a special presentation for Sir Lawrence's 60th birthday, he did not know that he would help to change the history of the solar system. Chapter 5. Out of the Ice. More than 100 years after Zeiss had built the first prototype in Jena in 1924, there were still a few optical planetarium projectors in use, looming dramatically over their audiences. But Hong Kong had retired its third-generation instrument decades ago in favor of the far more versatile electronic system. The whole of the Great Dome was essentially a giant television screen made up of thousands of separate panels on which any conceivable image could be displayed. The program had opened, inevitably, with a tribute to the unknown inventor of the rocket somewhere in China during the 13th century. The first 5 minutes were a high-speed historical survey, giving perhaps less than due credit to the Russian, German, and American pioneers, in order to concentrate on the career of Dr. Su Shenzhen. His countrymen could be excused in such a time and place if they made him appear as important in the history of rocket development as Goddard, von Braun, or Korolev, and they certainly had just grounds for indignation at his arrest on trumped-up charges in the United States when, after helping to establish the famed Jet Propulsion Laboratory and being appointed Caltech's first Goddard professor, he decided to return to his homeland. The launching of the first Chinese satellite by the Long March 1 rocket in 1970 was barely mentioned, perhaps because at that time the Americans were already walking on the moon. Indeed, the rest of the 20th century was dismissed in a few minutes to take the story up to 2007 and the secret construction of the spaceship Tian in full view of the whole world. The narrator did not gloat unduly over the consternation of the other spacefaring powers when a presumed Chinese space station suddenly blasted out of orbit and headed for Jupiter to overtake the Russian-American mission aboard the cosmonaut Alexei Leonov. The story was dramatic and tragic enough to require no embellishment. Unfortunately, there was very little authentic visual material to illustrate it. The program had to rely largely on special effects and intelligent reconstruction from later long-range photo surveys. During their brief sojourn on the icy surface of Europa, Tsien's crew had been far too busy to make television documentaries or even set up an unattended camera. Nevertheless, the words spoken at the time conveyed much of the drama of that first landing on the moons of Jupiter. The commentary broadcast from the approaching Leonov by Haywood Floyd served admirably to set the scene, and there were plenty of library shots of Europa to illustrate it. At this very moment, I'm looking at it through the most powerful of the ship's telescopes. Under this magnification, it's 10 times larger than the moon as you see it with naked eye, and it's a really weird sight. The surface is a uniform pink, with a few small brown patches. It's covered with an intricate network of narrow lines, curling and weaving in all directions. In fact, it looks very much like a photo from a medical textbook, showing a pattern of veins and arteries. A few of these features are hundreds or even thousands of kilometers long, and look rather like the illusory canals that Percival Lowell and other early 20th century astronomers imagined they'd seen on Mars. But Europa's canals aren't an illusion, though of course they're not artificial. What's more, they do contain water, or at least ice. For the satellite is almost entirely covered by ocean, averaging 50 kilometers deep. Because it's so far from the sun, Europa's surface temperature is extremely low, about 150 degrees below freezing. So one might expect its single ocean to be a solid block of ice. Surprisingly, that isn't the case because there's a lot of heat generated inside Europa by tidal forces, the same forces that drive the great volcanoes on neighboring Io.
So the ice is continually melting, breaking up, and freezing, forming cracks and lanes like those in the floating ice sheets in our own polar regions. It's that intricate tracery of cracks I'm seeing now. Most of them are dark and very ancient, perhaps millions of years old. But a few are almost pure white. They're the new ones that have just opened up and have a crust only a few centimeters thick. Cian has landed right beside one of these white streaks, the 1,500-kilometer-long feature that's been christened the Grand Canal. Presumably the Chinese intend to pump its water into their propellant tanks so that they can explore the Jovian satellite system and then return to Earth. That may not be easy, but they'll certainly have studied the landing site with great care and must know what they're doing. It's obvious now why they've taken such a risk, and why they claim Europa as a refueling point. It could be the key to the entire solar system. But it hadn't worked out that way, thought Sir Lawrence, as he reclined in his luxurious chair beneath the streaked and mottled disk that filled his artificial sky. The oceans of Europa were still inaccessible to mankind, for reasons that were still a mystery. And not only inaccessible, but invisible. Since Jupiter had become a sun, both its inner satellites had vanished beneath clouds of vapor boiling out from their interiors. He was looking at Europa as it had been back in 2010, not as it was today. He had been little more than a boy then, but could still remember the pride he felt in knowing that his countrymen, however much he disapproved of their politics, were about to make the first landing on a virgin world. There had been no camera there, of course, to record that landing, but the reconstruction was superbly done. He could really believe that was the doomed spaceship dropping silently out of the jet-black sky toward the Europan ice scape and coming to rest beside the discolored band of recently frozen water that had been christened the Grand Canal. Everyone knew what had happened next. Perhaps wisely, there had been no attempt to reproduce it visually. Instead, the image of Europa faded, to be replaced by a portrait as familiar to every Chinese as Yuri Gagarin's was to every Russian. The first photograph showed Rupert Chang on his graduation day in 1989, the earnest young scholar, indistinguishable from a million others, utterly unaware of his appointment with history 2 decades in the future. Briefly, to a background of subdued music, the commentator summed up the highlights of Dr. Chang's career until his appointment as science officer aboard Cian. Cross sections in time, the photographs grew older until the last one, taken immediately before the mission. Sir Lawrence was glad of the planetarium's darkness. Both his friends and his enemies would have been surprised to see the moisture gathering in his eyes as he listened to the message that Dr. Chang had aimed toward the approaching Leonov, never knowing if it would be received. "No, you are aboard, Leonov. May not have much time. Aiming my suit antenna where I think..." The signal vanished for agonizing seconds, then came back much clearer, though not appreciably louder. "Relay this information to Earth. Cian destroyed 3 hours ago. I'm only survivor. Using my suit radio. No idea if it has enough range, but it's the only chance. Please listen carefully. There is life on Europa. I repeat, there is life on Europa." The signal faded again. "Soon after local midnight, we were pumping steadily, and the tanks were almost half full. Dr. Lee and I went out to check the pipe insulation. Cian stood about 30 meters from the edge of the Grand Canal. Pipes go directly from it and down through the ice. Very thin. Not safe to walk on. The warm upwelling..." Again, a long silence. "No problem. 5 kilowatts of lighting strung up on the ship. Like a Christmas tree. Beautiful, shining right through the ice. Glorious colors. Lee saw it first. A huge dark mass rising up from the depths. At first we thought it was a school of fish, too large for a single organism. Then it started to break through the ice. Like huge strands of wet seaweed crawling along the ground, Lee ran back to the ship to get a camera. I stayed to watch, reporting over the radio. The thing moved so slowly I could easily outrun it. I was much more excited than alarmed.
Thought I knew what kind of creature it was. I've seen pictures of the kelp forests off California, but I was quite wrong. I could tell it was in trouble. It couldn't possibly survive at a temperature 150 below its normal environment. It was freezing solid as it moved forward. Bits were breaking off like glass, but it was still advancing toward the ship, a black tidal wave, slowing down all the time. I was still so surprised that I couldn't think straight and I couldn't imagine what it was trying to do. Climbing up the ship, building a kind of ice tunnel as it advanced. Perhaps this was insulating it from the cold, the way termites protect themselves from sunlight with their little corridors of mud. Tons of ice on the ship. The radio antennas broke off first. Then I could see the landing legs beginning to buckle, all in slow motion, like a dream. Not until the ship started to topple did I realize what the thing was trying to do. And then it was too late. We could have saved ourselves if we'd only switched off those lights. Perhaps it's a phototrope, its biological cycle triggered by the sunlight that filters through the ice. Or it could have been attracted like a moth to a candle. Our floodlights must have been more brilliant than anything that Europa has ever known. Then the ship crashed. I saw the hull split, a cloud of snowflakes form as moisture condensed. All the lights went out except for one, swinging back and forth on a cable a couple of meters above the ground. I don't know what happened immediately after that. The next thing I remember, I was standing under the light, beside the wreck of the ship, with a fine powdering of fresh snow all around me. I could see my footsteps in it very clearly. I must have run there. Perhaps only a minute or two had elapsed. The plant, I still thought of it as a plant, was motionless. I wondered if it had been damaged by the impact. Large sections, as thick as a man's arm, had splintered off, like broken twigs. Then the main trunk started to move again. It pulled away from the hull and began to crawl toward me. That was when I knew for certain that the thing was light-sensitive. I was standing immediately under the 1,000-watt lamp, which had stopped swinging now. Imagine an oak tree. Better still, a banyan with its multiple trunks and roots, flattened out by gravity and trying to creep along the ground. It got to within 5 meters of the light, then started to spread out until it had made a perfect circle around me. Presumably that was the limit of its tolerance, the point at which photoattraction turned to repulsion. After that, nothing happened for several minutes. I wondered if it was dead, frozen solid at last. Then I saw that large buds were forming on many of the branches. It was like watching a time-lapse film of flowers opening. In fact, I thought they were flowers, each about as big as a man's head. Delicate, beautifully colored membranes started to unfold. Even then, it occurred to me that no one, no thing, could ever have seen these colors before. They had no existence until we brought our lights, our fatal lights, to this world. Tendrils, stamens, waving feebly. I walked over to the living wall that surrounded me so that I could see exactly what was happening. Neither then, or at any other time, had I felt the slightest fear of the creature. I was certain that it was not malevolent, if indeed it was conscious at all. There were scores of the big flowers, in various stages of unfolding.
Now they reminded me of butterflies, just emerging from the chrysalis, wings crumpled, still feeble. I was getting closer and closer to the truth. But they were freezing, dying as quickly as they formed. Then, one after another, they dropped off from the parent buds. For a few moments, they flopped around like fish stranded on dry land. And at last, I realized exactly what they were. Those membranes weren't petals. They were fins, or their equivalent. This was the free-swimming larval stage of the creature. Probably it spends much of its life rooted on the seabed, then sends these mobile offspring in search of new territory, just like the corals of Earth's oceans. I knelt down to get a closer look at one of the little creatures. The beautiful colors were fading now to a drab brown. Some of the petal fins had snapped off, becoming brittle shards as they froze. But it was still moving feebly, and as I approached, it tried to avoid me. I wondered how it sensed my presence. Then I noticed that the stamens, as I'd called them, all carried bright blue dots at their tips. They looked like tiny star sapphires, or the blue eyes along the mantle of a scallop, aware of light, but unable to form true images. As I watched, the vivid blue faded, the sapphires became dull, ordinary stones. Dr. Floyd, or anyone else who is listening, I haven't much more time. Jupiter will soon block my signal. But I've almost finished. I knew then what I had to do. The cable to that 1,000-watt lamp was hanging almost to the ground. I gave it a few tugs, and the light went out in a shower of sparks. I wondered if it was too late. For a few minutes, nothing happened, so I walked over to the wall of tangled branches around me and kicked it. Slowly, the creature started to unweave itself and to retreat back to the canal. There was plenty of light. I could see everything perfectly. Ganymede and Callisto were in the sky. Jupiter was a huge, thin crescent, and there was a big auroral display on the night side at the Jovian end of the Io flux tube. There was no need to use my helmet light. I followed the creature all the way back to the water, encouraging it with more kicks when it slowed down, feeling the fragments of ice crunching all the time beneath my boots. As it neared the canal, it seemed to gain strength and energy, as if it knew that it was approaching its natural home. I wondered if it would survive, to bud again. It disappeared through the surface, leaving a few last dead larvae on the alien land. The exposed free water bubbled for a few minutes until a scab of protective ice sealed it from the vacuum above. Then I walked back to the ship to see if there was anything to salvage. I don't want to talk about that. I've only two requests to make, Doctor. When the taxonomists classify this creature, I hope they'll name it after me. And when the next ship comes home, ask them to take our bones back to China. Jupiter will be cutting us off in a few minutes. I wish I knew whether anyone was receiving me. Anyway, I'll repeat this message when we're in line of sight again, if my suit's life support system lasts that long. This is Professor Chang on Europa, reporting the destruction of spaceship Tien. We landed beside the Grand Canal and set up our pumps at the edge of the ice. The signal faded abruptly, came back for a moment, then disappeared completely below the noise level. There would never be any further message from Professor Chang, but it had already deflected Lawrence Sung's ambitions into space. Chapter 6. The Greening of Ganymede. Rolf Vandenberg was the right man, in the right place, at the right time. No other combination would have worked, which of course is how much of history is made. He was the right man because he was a second-generation Afrikaner refugee and a trained geologist. Both factors were equally important. He was in the right place because that had to be the largest of the Jovian moons, third outward in the sequence Io, Europa, Ganymede, Callisto. The time was not so critical, for the information had been ticking away like a delayed action bomb in the databanks for at least a decade. Vandenberg did not encounter it until 57. Even then, it took him another year to convince himself that he was not crazy. And it was 59 before he had quietly sequestered the original records so that no one could duplicate his discovery. Only then could he safely give his full attention to the main problem: what to do next. It had all begun, as is so often the case, with an apparently trivial observation in a field that did not even concern Vandenberg directly. His job as a member of the Planetary Engineering Task Force was to survey and catalog the natural resources of Ganymede. He had little business fooling around with the forbidden satellite next door. But Europa was an enigma that no one, least of all its immediate neighbors, could ignore for long. Every 7 days it passed between Ganymede and the brilliant mini-sun that had once been Jupiter, producing eclipses which could last as long as 12 minutes. At its closest, it appeared slightly smaller than the moon as seen from Earth, but it dwindled to a mere quarter of that size when it was on the other side of its orbit. The eclipses were often spectacular. Just before it slid between Ganymede and Lucifer, Europa would become an ominous black disk outlined with a ring of crimson fire as the light of the new sun was refracted through the atmosphere it had helped to create. In less than half a human lifetime, Europa had been transformed. The crust of ice on the hemisphere always facing Lucifer had melted to form the solar system's second ocean. For a decade, it had foamed and bubbled into the vacuum above it until equilibrium had been reached. Now Europa possessed a thin but serviceable, though not to human beings, atmosphere of water vapor, hydrogen sulfide, carbon and sulfur dioxides, nitrogen, and miscellaneous rare gases. Though the somewhat misnamed night side of the satellite was still permanently frozen, an area as large as Africa now had a temperate climate, liquid water, and a few scattered islands. All this, and not much more, had been observed through telescopes in Earth orbit. By the time that the first full-scale expedition had been launched to the Galilean moons in 2028, Europa had already become veiled by a permanent mantle of clouds. Cautious radar probing revealed little but smooth ocean on one face and almost equally smooth ice on the other. Europa still maintained its reputation as the flattest piece of real estate in the solar system. 10 years later, that was no longer true. Something drastic had happened to Europa. It now possessed a solitary mountain, almost as high as Everest, jutting up through the ice of the twilight zone. Presumably some volcanic activity, like that occurring ceaselessly on neighboring Io, had thrust this mass of material skyward. The vastly increased heat flow from Lucifer could have triggered such an event. But there were problems with this obvious explanation. Mount Zeus was an irregular pyramid, not the usual volcanic cone, and radar scans showed none of the characteristic lava flows. Some poor-quality photographs obtained through telescopes on Ganymede during a momentary break in the clouds suggested that it was made of ice, like the frozen landscape around it. Whatever the answer, the creation of Mount Zeus had been a traumatic experience for the world it dominated. For the entire crazy paving pattern of fractured ice flows over Nightside had changed completely. One maverick scientist had put forward the theory that Mount Zeus was a cosmic iceberg, a cometary fragment that had dropped upon Europa from space. Battered Callisto gave ample proof that such bombardments had occurred in the remote past. The theory was very unpopular on Ganymede, whose would-be colonists already had sufficient problems. They had been much relieved when Vandenberg had refuted the theory convincingly. Any mass of ice that size would have shattered on impact, and even if it hadn't, Europa's gravity, modest though it was, would have quickly brought about its collapse. Radar measurements showed that though Mount Zeus was indeed steadily sinking, its overall shape remained completely unaltered. Ice was not the answer. The problem could, of course, have been settled by sending a single probe through the clouds of Europa. Unfortunately, whatever was beneath that almost permanent overcast did not encourage curiosity. All these worlds are yours, except Europa. Attempt no landings there. That last message relayed from the spaceship Discovery just before its destruction had not been forgotten, but there had been endless arguments about its interpretation. Did landings refer to robot probes or only to manned vehicles? And what about close flybys, manned or unmanned, or balloons floating in the upper atmosphere? The scientists were anxious to find out, but the general public was distinctly nervous. Any power that could detonate the mightiest planet in the solar system was not to be trifled with. And it would take centuries to explore and exploit Io, Ganymede, Callisto, and the dozens of minor satellites. Europa could wait. More than once, therefore, Vandenberg had been told not to waste his valuable time on research of no practical importance when there was so much to be done on Ganymede. Where can we find carbon? Phosphorus, nitrates for the hydroponic farms. How stable is the Barnard escarpment? Is there any danger of more mudslides in Phrygia? And so on and so forth. But he had inherited his Boer ancestors' well-deserved reputation for stubbornness. Even when he was working on his numerous other projects, he kept looking over his shoulder at Europa. And one day, just for a few hours, a gale from Nightside cleared the skies about Mount Zeus. Chapter 7 Transit. I too take leave of all I ever had. From what depths of memory had that line come swimming up to the surface? Heywood Floyd closed his eyes and tried to focus on to the past. It was certainly from a poem, and he had hardly read a line of poetry since leaving college, and little enough then, except during a short English appreciation seminar. With no further clues, it might take the station computer quite a while, perhaps as much as 10 minutes, to locate the line in the whole body of English literature. But that would be cheating, not to mention expensive, and Floyd preferred to accept the intellectual challenge. A war poem, of course. But which war? There had been so many in the 20th century. He was still searching through the mental mists when his guests arrived, moving with the effortless slow-motion grace of long-time 1/6th gravity residents. The Society of Pasteur was strongly influenced by what had been christened centrifugal stratification. Some people never left the zero-g of the hub, while those who hoped one day to return to Earth preferred the almost normal weight regime out on the rim of the huge, slowly revolving disk. George and Jerry were now Floyd's oldest and closest friends, which was surprising because they had so few obvious points in common. Looking back on his own somewhat checkered emotional career, 2 marriages, 3 formal contracts, 2 informal ones, 3 children, he often envied the long-term stability of their relationship, apparently quite unaffected by the nephews from Earth or Moon who visited them from time to time. "Haven't you ever thought of divorce?" he had once asked them teasingly. As usual, George, whose acrobatic yet profoundly serious conducting had been largely responsible for the comeback of the classical orchestra, was at no loss for words. "Divorce? Never," was his swift reply. "Murder? Often." "Of course he'd never get away with it," Jerry had retorted. "Sebastian would spill the beans." Sebastian was a beautiful and talkative parrot that the couple had imported after a long battle with the hospital authorities. He could not only talk, but could reproduce the opening bars of the Sibelius violin concerto, with which Jerry, considerably helped by Antonio Stradivari, had made his reputation 50 years ago. Now the time had come to say goodbye to George, Jerry, and Sebastian, perhaps only for a few weeks, perhaps forever. Floyd had already made all his other farewells in a round of parties that had gravely depleted the station's wine cellar, and could think of nothing he had left undone. Archie, His early model, but still perfectly serviceable ComSec, had been programmed to handle all incoming messages, either by sending out appropriate replies or by routing anything urgent and personal to him aboard Universe. It would be strange, after all these years, not to be able to talk to anyone he wished, though in compensation he could also avoid unwanted callers. After a few days into the voyage, the ship would be far enough from Earth to make real-time conversation impossible, and all communication would have to be by recorded voice or teletext.
"We thought you were our friend," complained George. "It was a dirty trick to make us your executors, especially as you're not going to leave us anything." "You may have a few surprises," Floyd grinned. "Anyway, Archie will take care of all the details. I'd just like you to monitor my mail in case there's anything he doesn't understand."
"If he won't, neither will we. What do we know about all your scientific societies and that sort of nonsense?"
"They can look after themselves. Please see that the cleaning staff doesn't mess things up too badly while I'm away. And if I don't come back, here are a few personal items I'd like delivered. Mostly family."
Family. There were pains as well as pleasures in living as long as he had done. It had been 63 years since Marion had died in that air crash. Now he felt a twinge of guilt because he could not even recall the grief he must have known. Or at best, it was a synthetic reconstruction, not a genuine memory. What would they have meant to each other had she still been alive? She would have been just 100 years old by now. And now the two little girls he had once loved so much were friendly, gray-haired strangers in their late 60s, with children and grandchildren of their own. At last count, there had been 9 on that side of the family. Without Archie's help, he would never be able to keep track of their names. But at least they all remembered him at Christmas, through duty, if not affection. His second marriage, of course, had overlain the memories of his first, like the later writing on a medieval palimpsest. That, too, had ended 50 years ago, somewhere between Earth and Jupiter. Though he had hoped for a reconciliation with both wife and son, there had been time for only one brief meeting, among all the welcoming ceremonies, before his accident exiled him to Pasteur. The meeting had not been a success. Nor had the second, arranged at considerable expense and difficulty aboard the space hospital itself, indeed in this very room. Chris had been 20 then, and had just married. If there was one thing that united Floyd and Caroline, it was disapproval of his choice. Yet Helena had turned out remarkably well. She had been a good mother to Chris the second, born barely a month after the marriage, and when, like so many other young wives, she was widowed by the Copernicus disaster. She did not lose her head. There was a curious irony in the fact that both Chris 1 and 2 had lost their fathers to space, though in very different ways. Floyd had returned briefly to his 8-year-old son as a total stranger. Chris the second had at least known a father for the first decade of his life, before losing him forever. And where was Chris these days? Neither Caroline nor Helena, who were now the best of friends, seemed to know whether he was on Earth or in space. But that was typical. Only postcards date-stamped Clavius Base had informed his family of his first visit to the moon. Floyd's card was still taped prominently above his desk. Chris the second had a good sense of humor and of history. He had mailed his grandfather that famous photograph of the monolith looming over the space-suited figures gathered round it in the Tycho excavation more than half a century ago. All the others in the group were now dead, and the monolith itself was no longer on the moon. In 2006, after much controversy, it had been brought to Earth and erected, an uncanny echo of the main building, in the United Nations Plaza. It had been intended to remind the human race that it was no longer alone. 5 years later, with Lucifer blazing in the sky, no such reminder was needed. Floyd's fingers were not very steady. Sometimes his right hand seemed to have a will of its own as he unpeeled the card and slipped it into his pocket. It would be almost the only personal possession he would take when he boarded Universe. 25 days. You'll be back before we've noticed you're gone, said Jerry. And by the way, is it true that you'll have Dimitri on board? That little Cossack, George snorted. I conducted his second symphony back in 22. Wasn't that when the first violin threw up during the Largo? No, that was Mahler, not Mihailovich. And anyway, it was the brass, so nobody noticed, except the unlucky tuba player who sold his instrument the next day. You're making this up. Of course. But give the old rascal my love and ask him if he remembers that night we had out in Vienna. Who else have you got aboard? I've heard horrible rumors about press gangs, said Jerry thoughtfully. Greatly exaggerated, I can assure you. We've all been personally chosen by Sir Lawrence for our intelligence, wit, beauty, charisma, or other redeeming virtue. Not expendability. Well, now that you mention it, we've all had to sign a depressing legal document absolving Tsung Space Lines from every conceivable liability. My copy's in that file, by the way. Any chance of us collecting on it? Asked George, hopefully. No, my lawyers say it's ironclad. Tsung agrees to take me to Halley and back, give me food, water, air, and a room with a view. And in return? When I get back, I'll do my best to promote future voyages, make some video appearances, write a few articles. All very reasonable, for the chance of a lifetime. Oh yes, I'll also entertain my fellow passengers, and vice versa. How? Song and dance? Well, I hope to inflict selected portions of my memoirs on a captive audience. But I don't think I'll be able to compete with the professionals. Did you know that Eva Merlin will be on board? What? How did they coax her out of that Park Avenue cell? She must be 100 and... Oops. Sorry, hey. She's 70, plus or minus 5. Forget the minus. I was just a kid when Napoleon came out. There was a long pause while each of the trio scanned his memories of that famous work. Although some critics considered her Scarlett O'Hara to be her finest role, to the general public, Eva Merlin, nay Evelyn Miles, when she was born in Cardiff, South Wales, was still identified with Josephine. Almost half a century ago, David Griffin's controversial epic had delighted the French and infuriated the British, though both sides now agreed that he had occasionally allowed his artistic impulses to trifle with the historical record, notably in the spectacular final sequence of the Emperor's coronation in Westminster Abbey. That's quite a scoop for Sir Lawrence, said George thoughtfully. I think I can claim some credit for that. Her father was an astronomer. He worked for me at one time, and she's always been quite interested in science. So I made a few video calls. Heywood Floyd did not feel it necessary to add that, like a substantial fraction of the human race, he had fallen in love with Eva ever since the appearance of Gone with the Wind, Mark II. Of course, he continued, Sir Lawrence was delighted, but I had to convince him that she had more than a casual interest in astronomy. Otherwise, the voyage could be a social disaster. Which reminds me, said George, producing a small package he had been not very successfully hiding behind his back. We have a little present for you. Can I open it now? Do you think he should? Jerry wondered anxiously. In that case, I certainly will, said Floyd, untying the bright green ribbon and unwrapping the paper. Inside was a nicely framed painting. Although Floyd knew little of art, he had seen it before. Indeed, who could ever forget it? The makeshift raft tossing on the waves was crowded with half-naked castaways, some already moribund, others waving desperately at a ship on the horizon. Beneath it was the caption, The Raft of the Medusa, Théodore Géricault, 1791-1824. And underneath that was the message, signed by George and Jerry, Getting there is half the fun. You're a pair of bastards, and I love you dearly, said Floyd, embracing them both. The attention light on Archie's keyboard was flashing briskly. It was time to go. His friends left in a silence more eloquent than words. For the last time, Heywood Floyd looked around the little room that had been his universe for almost half his life. And suddenly, he remembered how that poem ended. "I have been happy. Happy now I go."